This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have us on the line, Ken Timmerman, who's written a wonderful book called Countdown to Crisis. And because of the situation in the Middle East, because of the growing tension with Iran, because I think of the very real possibility in view of the president's recently released national strategic strategy report, where he talks about the fact that we have a right to attack anyone we want to preemptively if we feel they're a threat to us, I really fear that we're approaching a point of perhaps no return for a war with Iran. But one of the big problems is that, according to Mr. Timmerman, there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that they already have some nuclear weapons they bought on the open market. Ken, thank you so very much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
Well, why don't you just go ahead and tell us, certainly you've been researching this as an independent investigative reporter for a long period of time. Your book, Countdown to Crisis, was talking about a lot of the things, a year ago. But what's your take on what's going on today?
Well, I think it's absolutely clear that the Iranian regime is hell-bent on acquiring nuclear weapons capabilities. We do not know how far along they are in their own programs, in other words, their ability to use their own uranium and their own plants to manufacture weapons. But we do know that they have, just recently this week, they've announced they have got a pilot enrichment plant up and running. They have announced that they want to install 3,000 centrifuges to enrich uranium. They have 85 tons of uranium gas that now have been refined in their own plants, which they could enrich, and if they did so, it would give them enough weapons material for 10 bombs, probably by the end of the year.
Well, do you think that they may already have purchased some bombs at on the open market?
There are also reports, which I am led to believe are credible, that the Iranians have bought weapons, actual weapons, from North Korea that were originally Soviet weapons, Russian weapons, from SSN-6 missiles. These are 40-year-old missile systems, but still active, and this was done probably in the last 2 years.
Well, now, what about strategic missiles, something like intermediate-range missiles? Is that what they have, or do they have more up-to-date missiles from North Korea?
Well, the SSN-6 missile is an intermediate-range missile. We don't know whether they have the actual missiles, which are capable of reaching targets approximately 2,000 miles away, or whether they just have the warheads. But this said, Iran's capability right now, they have missiles that can hit Israel, that can hit U.S. Bases all across the Middle East, and we know that they have nuclear weapons designs.
And, of course, they also would be able to hit our fleet there in the Indian Ocean, wouldn't they?
You bet, but they wouldn't need long-range missiles to do that, Dr. Stan. They could do that, unfortunately, with Silkworm missiles purchased from China. They can use coastal batteries. They have a lot of other capabilities where they can hit us locally.
And, of course, the problem is that, we may be very well moving into a major confrontation. And this, if we get into a battle with Iran, it's not going to be a cakewalk like it was with Iraq. And look at all the trouble we're having with Iraq, which was really pretty much demilitarized before we went in there after being bombed daily for a period of 10 years. We'll be right back with Mr. Timmerman. Well, Ken, it's tension seems to be rising over there. Do you sense that as well? You're certainly pretty close to the center of power back there in Washington, D.C.
Clearly the tension is rising. There's no doubt about that. As to what a military confrontation would ultimately look like, I think we need to be very cautious in looking at this and very realistic. First of all, no one in Washington is talking about a massive invasion of Iran should the Iranians make some kind of military moves. And by the way, I think that's what is going to happen. I think the Iranians are going to precipitate this. I don't think that there will be a preemptive U.S. military strike. This administration doesn't want to do it. And I don't think there's a great deal of willingness in Congress to support that either. But the Iranian regime has plans, and I've looked at those plans recently, and I can tell you that they've been working on these for well over a decade to close the Strait of Hormuz, through which about 20% of the world's oil transits every day, and we know that they have the weapons to do this. Let me give you a couple examples. The Iranians have purchased from China C-802 missiles. These are anti-shipping missiles. They have a range of about 60 to 70 miles. They're over the horizon, which means that you can't see them on the sea, and they are sea-skimming missiles, supersonic and sea-skimming. We essentially do not have anything that can shoot those missiles down. They can take out major U.S. warships, not an aircraft carrier, but they could take out corvettes and frigates and destroyers, should we have them there. They also have bottom-tethered mines, which they purchased from the Russians and from the Chinese. These mines are able to identify the ships going overhead. When they see a small vessel, they do not release. When they see an aircraft carrier, they do. They are rocket-propelled, and they rocket up from the bottom of the Persian Gulf at 70 miles an hour and hit the hull of the ship. People I've spoken to who are naval experts believe that they could actually sink a U.S. aircraft carrier with that kind of mine. So they have serious capabilities, and they are wargaming how they could use those capabilities against the American fleet and indeed an international fleet in the Persian Gulf.
Well, of course, the thing that frightens me is I think there are some people in Iran who are quite irrational and would like to bring about a Third World War. Have you had that impression at all, reading and studying about this?
Well, the current president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who I profile in Countdown to Crisis, is a very scary figure. This is a man who took power in August of 2005, just last year. He announced publicly that the goal of his new government was going to be to hasten the return of the 12th Imam, the Imam Mahdi of Shiite Islam. Now, this happened...
Could you hold that just a moment here, please, Ken? Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Ken Timmerman, and we're basically talking about this idea that Mr. Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, really wants to bring about the return of the 12th Imam, or the Mahdi. And so perhaps for our listeners who are not acquainted with this idea of the 12th Imam, they don't even know who the Mahdi is, but could you tell them about that?
Yeah, briefly, here's what happened, Dr. Stan. In Islamic theology, there were 12 descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. The 12th one, the 12th Imam, died at the age of 5. They believe he disappeared, not died, and this was in the year of our Lord 941. And ever since then, he's been hiding, so goes the story, at the bottom of a well near, not too far from Tehran in Iran. So when Ahmadinejad takes power in August of 2005, he declares that the goal of his government is to hasten the return of this 12th Imam. And again, according to their theology, that only happens when there is a world war, a massively destructive world war. So Ahmadinejad says, my goal is to bring about this world war, to bring about the return of the 12th Imam. That's what he's all about.
And the Mahdi really is a figure, a mythological figure, that is a very, very similar to the Maitreya that the Hindu waits for, the Messiah that the Jews wait for. They believe, and I shouldn't say it's a mythological figure, they really believe with all their heart that this is the person who will come to lead the world.
Just a messianic figure, correct.
A messianic figure, right.
That's correct. A messianic figure who, again, according to the Shiite Islamic theology, he will rule at the end of the world in perfect Islamic harmony, and at that point there will only be Muslims left. So the Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, believes two things. One, his goal is to bring about this world war, and two, that world war will kill the rest of the non-believers, the Christians and the Jews and the Hindus and everyone else who is not yet converted to Islam.
And of course, this then would tend to explain some of the incredible statements that the president of Iran has been making, like, well, of course, we should wipe Israel off the face of the earth. The Holocaust didn't take place. We should send Israel back to Europe and set the state of Israel up in Europe. We are going to go ahead and enrich our uranium. Doesn't it matter what the other people in the world want? We're going to... It's almost like they're trying to provoke a confrontation. Is that your feeling?
Well, I think that's right. And it's troubling to see that this man is in control of the Revolutionary Guards Corps, which is now the primary military force in Iran. He controls the missile brigades. He controls the nuclear weapons program. Obviously, the clerics are sharing power with him, but he has his finger on the trigger.
And, of course, we have a lot of, you know, at least within the Shias, there is this sect. It's, what is it, the Hojatiya Society, who holds to this idea of the 12th Imam. This is really a rather new idea. I'd never heard it before a few months ago.
Well, it's been around for a long time, but you're right. It has not been talked about very much recently. What's kind of ironic about this is that the Hojatiya sect is considered so extreme, even in revolutionary Iran, that Ayatollah Khomeini banned them right after the revolution in 1979, and they had to go underground. They still existed. They were not persecuted as partisans of the former Shah were persecuted, but they had to go underground, and it's only with this new president, Ahmadinejad, that they are out in full force, and you find that they're in the so-called parliament, the Majlis. They're clerics, prominent clerics who are supporting him, who are members of the Hojatiya sect. And again, this is a messianic end-of-the-world sect that believes that they need to bring about a world war to fulfill the prophecies of messianic Islam.
And, of course, rational men would be, just frightened to death, would certainly do everything they could to avoid a third world war. And yet here we're seeing Iranian leaders who actually want to provoke a world war. This is what, to me, is so frightening about it, is there this awareness back in Washington, D.C., that we may be walking into a trap that they're laying for us?
Well, I'm not so sure that the leaders in Washington are looking at this as a trap. I think they're watching very carefully Iranian moves. They're watching Iranian capabilities, and they're trying to judge what those capabilities are what they could do to U.S. forces. And they're very concerned about the naval capabilities. I spoke about that a few minutes earlier. They see that Iran does have the ability to do serious damage to a U.S. or international fleet. In fact, I can tell you, they held last year a naval exercise with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan aimed at deploying minesweepers in the Persian Gulf, and especially in the Strait of Hormuz, to see if they would be able to counter that eventuality of an Iranian blockade of the Strait of Hormuz.
What happened?
Well, they're still working at it.
Okay.
We do not have, we only have, I think, two minesweepers in the region. Now, the Iranians have done this before. It's something we need to remember. When you're looking at capabilities, they tried to close the Strait of Hormuz in 1987, 1988, when at the end of their 8-year war with Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And they sunk a number of, they didn't sink them, but they damaged a number of oil tankers, and they damaged a U.S. warship. And eventually we had to call on NATO to bring in minesweepers because we did not have enough minesweepers in the U.S. Navy.
Well, now, where does Israel fit into this whole situation, and what do you think that Israel is going to do faced with the threat? Because, of course, we're sitting over here in the United States, and although we have our fleet and our men over there, it's not as if, the very, very center of our society is threatened, at least not at the present time, but Israel feels very threatened by Iran.
Well, they do, and the Israelis believe, and I think rightly so, that they will be on the receiving end of any nuclear-tipped missiles which are launched by the Iranian regime. And that's why they have said repeatedly they will not allow Iran to become a nuclear weapon state. But, they're walking this one, Dr. Stan, right down to the razor's edge. The Israelis desperately do not want to have to launch a military strike on Iran. They understand very well that this will have devastating implications, devastating results for the entire Middle East.
And of course, if the Israelis were to launch a strike on Iran and we were to back Israel, even we might condemn them publicly, but everybody would know they would have to have had our permission to do it, then wouldn't this inflame the entire Islamic world against the United States?
I don't think it would, frankly. There's not a great deal of love for the Iranian regime in the predominantly Sunni areas of the Arab world, and that's most of the Arab world. Saudi Arabia, it's Kuwait, it's Iraq. Iraq is more than half Shia, but, you know, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, these are not countries which are great lovers of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I don't think that they would see this as a religious fight. They would see it, properly so, as a preemptive attack against a real threat, and a threat even to them. The Iranians are rogue players in the Middle East. They have attacked the Saudis in the past. They have attacked the Kuwaitis. They tried to assassinate the Kuwaiti emir in the early 1980s. They have seized islands in the Persian Gulf from the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, and Sharjah. You know, they have a track record of launching aggressions against their neighbors near and far. So they're not terribly well-liked in the region.
Well, of course, in Egypt, though, isn't there a growing support for the radical form of Islam, for the people in the Muslim Brotherhood? And isn't that really spreading through in Pakistan and so many of those areas of the Muslim world, even though there is the friction between the Shia and the Sunni Muslim? Isn't there a growing shift over to this radical form of Islam?
Yes, there is. You're absolutely right about that, and it's something we need to keep our eyes on, and it's very disturbing. But at the same time, there are national differences and religious differences, and I would argue that in most cases, those national and religious differences are greater. It's easier to break the eggs over nationalism than it is to glue them back together through Islam.
All right, fine. Well, let's talk a little bit about something that you've talked about in the past, and this would be Osama bin Laden. Now, of course, we've been hearing for a long time, oh, our government wants to do everything they can to get the wicked Osama bin Laden, but didn't Congressman Kirk Weldon actually, wasn't he actually told where Osama was staying for a time, and when he wanted to do something to get him, to eliminate him, the head of the snake, as it were, of this radical movement, why, he was blocked by the CIA. What's that story?
Yeah, it's a pretty extraordinary story. And you know, by the way, U.S. Congress. Well, we'll get into what U.S. congressmen should or should not be doing. But Kurt Weldon is an extraordinary member of Congress, a Republican from Pennsylvania. I've known him for many, many years, and he's one of the rare members of Congress who actually goes out, talks to original sources himself. He does on-the-ground investigations. He goes to Russia. He goes to the Middle East. He was the man who opened up Libya and got Gaddafi to renounce his nuclear weapons and to open up his country to the United States. In fact, I went with Kurt Weldon to Libya in February of 2004. It was the first delegation from the United States, the first congressional delegation to go to the Libyan People's Congress, and it was quite an experience. So this is a member of Congress who is not your everyday Congress critter. Okay, he's quite an individual, Mr. Weldon.
I've heard him speak personally, and he certainly is a powerful speaker and a man you would tend to respect.
Yes, indeed. And at any rate, Mr. Weldon had been in contact with a source, an Iranian source, exile source in Paris. And this individual had sources within the regime in Tehran, and he was providing Mr. Weldon with intelligence, and at a certain point in 2003, they believed that they had located the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden in Iran, and Mr. Weldon was hoping to encourage the CIA to put together a team to go get him.
And, of course, the CIA wasn't that interested.
No, and George Tenet, then director of the CIA, kind of looked at Mr. Weldon and he said, Congressman, I don't think you want to get involved in this kind of thing.
Well, I think that somebody ought to be involved, after all, at least as far as the Islamic people is concerned. Why, you know, Osama bin Laden is a hero to many of them. And the fact that we've never been able to get him, but I think it's really because we've never tried to get him. The myth of Osama bin Laden goes on and on and on. Well, we're going to be back in just a few minutes with Ken Timmerman, his book, Countdown to Crisis, and we carry the book. We think it's an important book. Well, Ken, why don't you pick up the rest of the story? Anyway, of course, then I assume that Congressman Weldon abandoned his effort to do something independently. But certainly the stories have been that some of Bin Laden's at least been part of the time in Iran. Do you think that's valid?
Oh, I definitely. And I have my own independent sources, and I know others who have their independent sources. There are at least three reporting streams about Bin Laden in Iran over the past 3 years. And I'll give you one example, again, from my book, Countdown to Crisis. One of my sources actually had photographs of meetings between Bin Laden in November of 2004 and top Iranian government officials. And here's an interesting detail. In those pictures, he had a feeding tube, or a tube that was feeding him medicine on the back of one of his hands.
Right.
Now, there have been rumors recently that Bin Laden may, in fact, have died in Iran over the past couple of weeks. And if so, it would suggest that these earlier pictures showed a very sick individual. Certainly he looked very old in the pictures, but he may have been very sick as well at the same time, and so, you know, he may indeed be dead.
In fact, we've heard the same stories too, but it's interesting, you don't hear them through the regular media, you hear them through people who got them from people who are, you know, ordinarily very, very, certainly right on the cutting edge of what's going on. So, now, have you read this in the public media? Because I haven't, but I've heard the rumors.
Well, again, this is a story that comes from Congressman Weldon and from his sources, his source in Paris, who is plugged in through Manoush Ghorbanifar to people who are quite senior within the Iranian regime. Now, I have not been able to independently validate that story. But again, Mr. Weldon himself is a credible individual. He's a serious member of Congress, and I think we need to take it seriously.
Well, if Michael Ledeen has written about this, and Michael Ledeen seems to have his finger on a lot of what's going on behind the scenes. Do you know Mr. Ledeen?
Very well. He's a neighbor of mine.
All right, fine then. Well, then I won't tell any stories out of school here, but this is sort of what I've heard. All right. Well, then, of course, you're very, very concerned. Of course, is there any sort of a timetable before the crisis comes down, or do you think it's just really going to, we're just going to have to wait and see how the story unfolds?
Well, let's look at the Iranian capabilities. With 85 tons of uranium gas, 3,000 centrifuges, and these are capabilities that they have acknowledged that they've had, and the International Atomic Energy Agency has been able to confirm on the ground, they could enrich now enough nuclear material to make 10 bombs within anywhere from 6 months to a year. And that's, in my opinion, the outside envelope that we're looking at, 6 months to a year. It could happen much, much quicker. There is a dramatic Iranian naval buildup going on as we speak. They are conducting exercises, and they are flexing their muscles, if you wish. I would say that this crisis is coming to a head now, and it's going to be over the next months and as much as the next year.
All right, fine. Now, what about the relationship between Iran and Chavez in Central America? Certainly Chavez is a Marxist, and the Iranians are Islamists, but is there any sort of a liaison between those two groups?
You bet. And there's a very troubling, deep relationship between Iran, Venezuela's Chavez, and also Cuba. Let's not forget Cuba in all of this.
Well, of course, here are these Marxists, and they're working with Islamists. That doesn't seem quite right, and yet I'm sure you're right.
Well, you know, we have to remember that the mullahs in Tehran and the leaders in Tehran...
Hold that thought right there, please, Ken, for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly off the air we were talking with Ken. He was saying that, you know, there's rumors have gone around that actually Osama bin Laden has died recently, and there have been pictures taken of him where he looked very, very ill and was getting intravenous. This was some months ago. And then the other thing we were beginning to talk about was the relationship between the Iranian government, which hates America, and Venezuela. Which hates America, and Cuba, which the leaders hate America. So pick up the story there, Ken, please.
Well, we've seen is quite a large number of diplomatic trips back and forth between the two countries. We've seen Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, a major oil exporter, by the way, and a major provider of U.S. oil, say that he would join any Iranian oil boycott should the Iranians decide to take their oil off their market in a confrontation with the Western powers. So if you add Iran's 2.5 to 3 million barrels a day plus Venezuela's 2 million barrels a day, you're talking a serious shortage at the gas pump.
And, of course, this would have a profound impact not only on the price of oil, but certainly on the price of everything in the United States. This would almost precipitate a real crisis if this price of oil were to shoot up to $80 or $100 a barrel.
Well, I can tell you something, Dr. Stan. If the two of them joined together, it wouldn't be $80 or $100. It would be $150 or $200 a barrel, and it wouldn't be a crisis. It would be a war. So if you have the two going together, I don't really think that there's any... There's no ambiguity. The United States would be in a state of war, and we would have to respond militarily. We're not there yet, and right now what's going on is an attempt by the Bush administration to walk this back, if possible, to convince the Iranian regime, which I think is going to be difficult, to open up their nuclear facilities, to engage in transparent inspections with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Again, I don't think it's going to happen, but it's a last-ditch effort to avoid a war.
Well, of course, the frightening thing is that apparently the current president of Iran really does want a war. He's not a rational man. We're not dealing with rational people. And with that understanding, then a lot of this really tends to make sense. So you certainly cover many, many things in your book, Countdown to Crisis. Now, you've actually had access to some intelligence sources, haven't you, that are not widely known, or at least not widely accepted by our intelligence agencies?
I talked to an awful lot of defectors from Iranian intelligence organizations, as well as people in our intelligence community. Dr. Stan, just for a second, I'd like to just take issue with one thing. I think that we need to be careful when we talk about Iran's leaders and calling them irrational, because it's not that they're irrational. It's not that Ahmadinejad, who believes in the Hojati effect and the 12th Imam, it's not that he's irrational. He's incredibly rational in his own irrational way.
You're absolutely right, of course. From our point of view, it's irrational. From his point of view, it's entirely rational.
Absolutely, and there's a great deal of logic, let's put it that way. There's a great deal of logic in the way that he thinks. It's just not the way that we think, and it's not the same calculus. For him, for instance, it makes perfect sense to trade have a nuclear weapons exchange with the State of Israel. And by the way, he's not the only one. The so-called moderate mullah, the moderate cleric Rafsanjani, the former president, has said, and I quote him in my book, he said it's perfectly perfectly imaginable to have a nuclear weapons exchange with Israel. Millions will die in the Islamic world. That's okay. If one bomb from us hits Israel, they will be wiped off the map, and that is our goal. So it's that different kind of logic, if you wish, which is driving them. It's still, there is a logic, but it's a calculus which is a calculus of genocide.
I'll never forget, many years ago I was traveling in Israel and of course on a tour bus, and the tour guide was obvious he was very concerned about something. They were listening to all of these programs in Arabic, and of course we were the Christian group traveling there, and so I went back to the hotel, and there was a radio there, had an English broadcast, and it said that Rafsanjani had ordered people to start killing tourists American tourists in Israel. And I'll never forget that. Of course, I didn't want to tell the rest of the older people with me on the tour that this was the order from Rafsanjani, who at that time was a very high position in Iran. This was maybe 20 years ago, 15 years or so ago. But Rafsanjani has always been very close to my heart ever since then.
I can understand why.
Well, now, what about Pakistan? Where is Pakistan going to fit into this whole scenario?
Well, that's a good question, and you have to separate, I think, Musharraf, who's the president, who's been very helpful in the war on terror, and his intelligence agencies, who have not.
All right, fine. Well, let's talk about the intelligence agencies, and what they've been doing, because haven't they actually been, in many respects, fighting and helping this radical form of Islam?
You bet, and they have been closely allied to Osama bin Laden. It's Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence, ISI, which helped build up the Taliban, and they are today working with these radical madrasas in Pakistan, where young people are being trained, indoctrinated, if you wish, in radical Islamic thought.
And these are actual schools, and there are about 20,000 of them there in Iran.
Right.
Might be in Pakistan.
Absolutely correct.
Hold that right there. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this afternoon is Ken Timmerman, and we're talking about his book, Countdown to Crisis. And in just a moment or two, when we pull all of our stations back with us, I will let you go ahead and get out your website. But anyway, what's going to happen as far as Pakistan? Certainly, there have been a number of unsuccessful attempts on Musharraf's life, but one of these times it's going to they're going to succeed, and when they do, we're going to see Pakistan in the hands of other radical Islamists. I think that is a very frightening thing to contemplate.
It sure is, and remember, when we're contemplating this, remember that Pakistan is a nuclear weapon state. They, as India did in 1998, they tested nuclear weapons. They were successful. They demonstrated that they had a capability, and we know that they have been making additional nuclear weapons material. So what's going to happen to all of those nuclear weapons should a radical Islamic group take over the government of Pakistan? That is a very serious and scary question.
And I really share your concern about it. And I think that a lot of people here in America, I think that's over there, and that just involves some of our troops over there. They don't understand that what is unfolding in the Middle East, I think, is going to have a profound impact on the lives of everybody here in America. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the world is getting smaller, Dr. Stan. I mean, it's crystal clear. More and more Americans are living abroad. Our economy is clearly imbricated in the world economy. They cannot sneeze in the oil fields in the Middle East without us catching a cold over here. Pakistan is important because of the huge population that they have, because of the capability of sending people out, sending terrorists out around the world. Iran is important because they sit astride so much oil, and they control the Strait of Hormuz. 20% of the world's oil supplies go through there daily. Saudi Arabia is in potential turmoil. You have the kingdom, the king and the royal family who are fragile, who are being disputed by radical Islamic clerics again in that country. And all of this is not far away. We think it's far away, but you're right to point that out. It is not far away. We depend on that part of the world for our economic well-being.
And, of course, our fate, our foreign policy is intricately intertwined with the future of Israel. And Israel, of course, is going to be a constant source of conflict over there. The Arabs hate the Israelis, and I think it's mutual. I think this has always been the way it is, and I don't know what the solution is.
Well, I don't think there's any solution. I think right now the Israelis are going to hang tough and build their future within their own borders. And if their Arab neighbors want to live with them in peace,
hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is Ken Timmerman. His book is Countdown to Crisis. It's an important book. We carry it, and we certainly recommend it to you. Now, Ken, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out?
Sure. You can read my articles at kentimmerman.com, which is simply my name, K-E-N Timmerman, T-I-M-M-E-R-M-A-N.com. You can also read my stories at Front Page Magazine or at Newsmax. I write for both of those publications on a regular basis.
And, of course, Ken used to write for Insight Magazine, and suddenly all of the advertisers at Insight suddenly just quit advertising.
That's
and
right.
One of the finest news magazines we had in the country suddenly just overnight sort of went out of business. So, anyway, but we still can get Ken's Timmerman's information up on the Internet. If you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a who has a better grasp of what's going on in the Middle East than Ken, his book really gives you tremendous insight. And what, of course, do these intelligence people who have ties to Iran tell you? There must be an awful lot of people in Iran who are frightened to death at what is unfolding and the prospects of there being some sort of a nuclear exchange.
Well, that's absolutely true, and there's also a lot of people in Iran who are very upset with this regime, but they feel powerless. They the regime has all the weapons, they have all the police and the military, and whenever the people have demonstrations, they are roundly beaten and jailed, and so they feel powerless. We desperately need to help and to empower the people of Iran. They are our best secret weapon against this regime. We need to understand that the regime is the target. It's not even the nuclear weapons. You know, if we were worried about nuclear weapons, we'd be worried about Great Britain. We need to be worried about the regime, the terrorist regime, with its finger on those nuclear weapons.
And, of course, really, Iran has been responsible for financing terrorism ever since 1979. I mean, certainly they were involved directly with the bombing of the American embassy in Lebanon and the killing of the 241 Marines in 1983.
Absolutely. And, you know, imagine what it would be like in this country if we had a clique of 5 million radical wackos who are running the intelligence services, running the military, and going out around the world fomenting coups and blowing up buildings and embassies and you know, killing troops from other countries and blowing up ships and never getting caught for it. I mean, it's really an extraordinary thing that's been going on for 26 years in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
And, of course, I mean, certainly I remember when they actually kidnapped the CIA station chief in Lebanon and tortured him to death. And we did absolutely nothing about it.
Bill Buckley.
Incredible. And Buckley, right?
That's right. And you know, I feel a great deal of sympathy for the Iranian people who watch all this happening and who really, you know, they're thinking, well, we don't want to be considered terrorists because of the activities of this group of thugs, and yet they feel powerless to get rid of them. That's why I think it's very much in our national interest to help the Iranian people, to empower them to get rid of these thugs in Tehran.
Well, I know that certainly the Bush administration has appropriated, I don't know, $25 or $50 million, something like that, on a propaganda campaign to try to change the regime in Tehran. Simply by bringing pressure to bear by one means or another by propaganda. Do you think that that's going to have any influence?
Well, it's a start. They're talking about $75 million. We'll see how much makes it through the authorization process. You know, that's a whittling down in Congress, as it should be. Yes, I think it will have an impact. And the ruling clerics in Iran are hysterical when they view any American effort to possibly overthrow them, because they believe the day that the United States actually goes against them and actually declares this regime an enemy, they believe that they will fall.
Well, certainly, I would think that there should be very little question in anybody's mind that they are the enemy. They have been the enemy ever since they came to power back in 1979.
Right, but we haven't done anything about it. And now finally, the U.S. administration, Condoleezza Rice in particular, but the president as well, have said that we are going to start to do something about it and start to help the Iranian pro-democracy movement. I think it's about time, and it's our best possible move.
Well, now, what about Turkey? Certainly, Turkey is a very unusual country because there's a large Islamic movement there, and yet, of course, the army, which is really in total control, really is more or less secular, going all the way back to Ataturk. What's going to happen in Turkey? Is the military in solid control there?
Well, that is a very good question, and there's quite a bit of tension between the military, which is secular, as you rightly mentioned, and the current government of Erdogan, who's an Islamist prime minister. And I'm very concerned about Erdogan. I'll give you an example. In 1994, he made a speech where he said, you have to choose between, you cannot choose, you have to choose between being a Muslim or a secularist. You cannot be the two together. And a lot of people have believed that you can have a secular Muslim country. And here's this leader, Erdogan, who said, no, you can't. Either you're Muslim, and if you're Muslim, you're that way all the way, or you believe in a secular rule, in which case you're no longer a Muslim. So this is a very disturbing trend. I think, in fact, Erdogan is probably correct that this is the predominant trend now through the Islamic world to make it impossible to have secular government. By the way, our friends in Iran, the pro-democracy groups in Iran, are desperate for secular government. They have been the victims for 26 years of an Islamic Republic, and they know just how bad it can be.
And I think that what our listeners probably don't understand is that if you are an Islamic Republic, why, you know, you live under Sharia law. Isn't that the way it worked?
Yep. Yes, that's correct. And for instance, girls get married off at the age of 9. In Iran, they have a particular form of prostitution, which is authorized by a cleric. You have to get a mullah. You go pay the mullah as the pimp. And when you pay the mullah a certain fee, he will then give you what's called a temporary marriage, otherwise known as prostitution. But it's legal in that case. You are legally married temporarily to a woman of pleasure. and prostitution has become extraordinarily rampant in today's Iran, as, by the way, has opium use, drug use.
Well, it's really, really now, of course, isn't that frowned on by the government, or is it?
No, that's what's kind of interesting. The government, the Islamic government in Iran, the so-called Islamic government, has actually been pushing drugs and encouraging young people to use drugs because it's a way of taking them out of the opposition. If you're doped up, you're not out on the streets protesting.
I never heard that before. I mean, I can see where the logic in it, but it would be, it seemed to me, coming from a Christian worldview, that would be the most ridiculous thing in the world. I'm not suggesting that they're not doing it. It's just that they look at the world entirely differently, and I think that's so important for our listeners to understand. These people look at the world differently than we do. They have a different worldview.
Absolutely correct. And I mean, you can just see this in the figures. The statistics of drug use in Iran are just going through the roof. And every time whenever I talk to Iranians who have just come back from Tehran or any of the large cities, they're really just tearing their hair. They're stunned by the extent of the drug use and prostitution. Those two social phenomena, which are the most dramatic these days.
But of course, this will tear apart the very heart of a nation, and maybe it'll take that to topple the clerics.
Well, once again, if you're doped up on heroin or on opium, you're not going to be in the streets demonstrating. And I think that's what the regime is counting on.
Well, now, what can the is there anything the average individual can do? Do we just sort of have to sit here on the sidelines like the people do over in Tehran and just say there's nothing we can do? We just hope it gets straightened out properly before we're involved in a nuclear confrontation.
Well, no, I think it's very important to get information, to listen to shows like this one, to learn more about what's going on inside Iran, what the real issues are, to be able to see through some of the lies that are being told by the by some of the large media organizations in this country, some of the national television networks, and some of the formerly mainstream newspapers. I'll give you just one example. I have a regular column in Front Page magazine. Last week I did a story about disinformation being used by the Iranian regime creeping into places like the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, and the regime in Iran has been very successful in convincing reporters from these American media organizations that in fact Iranian people support the clerical regime, they like the Islamic Republic, and they want nuclear weapons. I mean, it's absolutely stunning, and it goes against everything that I am able to find out, and my sources are able to find out from inside Iran, from people on the street and political organizations who are opposed to the regime. That is not what the Iranian people want.
Well, is there any organized opposition there? I should say organized, but the subterranean, so that, it's not obvious, because if the Iranian government were to find them, they would obviously lock them up and torture them and maybe even kill them. But is there an organized opposition within the country?
There is an opposition, and there's a lot of it. The problem is it is not as organized as it should be, and for exactly the reasons that you just point out, because it's extremely dangerous. Yes, there are political parties that exist underground, and I've been in contact with a number of them, and there are also more ad hoc organizations. You have journalists, such as Akbar Ganji, who was just released from jail, and others. You have, lawyers and doctors and professionals, former regime people who have split with the regime. There's a great deal of opposition inside Iran. Again, the problem is it's not as organized as it must be to be able to overthrow this regime.
And, of course, this is a great tragedy of our time, is that we have a group there, really more or less fanatical, who really seem to be almost welcoming the idea of a confrontation with the United States. And the trouble is, when you start a war, you never know how that war is going to end. And certainly the people in Europe had no idea how the First World War was going to end, because it destroyed, the whole structure of Europe at that time. All the great empires were severely damaged or either destroyed. So, my concern is if we get into a major war over there and the Iranians get into a major war, how is it going to end?
Well, nobody knows that. And that is why I think all of the efforts, both by the United States, by our European friends, by the Israelis, all of our efforts have been to try to keep this from becoming a shooting war. My fear, again, is that the Iranian regime, with its messianic philosophy and its military capabilities, which have been strengthening over the past decade, will in fact provoke this war because they believe it's in their interest.
And of course it would be in their interest because that would bring back the Mahdi. And that of course is their major thrust, at least for this small sect that seems to be in such a position of power over there. Is actually the president of Iran a member of the sect, or is he simply working with them? Do we know?
I believe that he's a sympathizer of the Hojatiya sect, and his spiritual guide, a guy named Ayatollah Mezbah Yazdi, is in fact the leader of the Hojatiya sect. So he is very, very closely involved with this sect, yes.
And I would certainly suggest to our listeners out there, go to the internet and look up the Hojatiya, you probably spell it better than I do, H-O-J-J-A-T-E-H, something like that?
Yes, that's something like that, and you can use different variations, H-O-J-A-T-I-E-H, the different variations, but look up the 12th Imam, the 12th Imam as well, or you can go to my website, kentimmerman.com, and you'll find articles about Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, and their ruling philosophy.
And I think it's so important, ladies and gentlemen, to go to Ken's site. If he's got the material there, I apologize for not having been on your site to look it up. I enjoyed your book, but I haven't. I don't have the time to do the research. I wish I did. But I think that for our listeners out there, we are on the verge of some very, very frightening things happening. And you need to be informed, and you need to let the average American know. I don't think the average American has ever heard of the Hojatiya unless they listen to my program or go to your website. In fact, the only place I ever read about it was an article by Anna de Borgreit, who I've written a book. Pardon me, written an article.
Right.
A friend of the Washington Times.
Right.
Well, you know, is there any parting thought that you'd like to have for our listeners today?
Well, again, I think we all need to fasten our seatbelts and get ready for a rough and rocky ride. The next 6 months to a year are not going to be easy. The Iranian regime believes that they can steer the course of human events towards war. They believe that that's to their advantage. They have built up the weaponry that they need to do this over the past 10 years, and now they have become, in my opinion, a virtual nuclear weapon state, if not an actual nuclear weapon state. So, folks, we need to be listening, arming ourselves with the truth, go out and get as much information as you possibly can about what's going on, and keep pressure on your members of Congress that they do the right thing, that they understand that we're in a war against the terrorists who would like to destroy our way of life and our nation.
All right, God bless you, and thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Stan.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And our guest has been Ken Timmerman. His book has been The Countdown to Crisis. We carry the book. We think it's an important book. We carry a number of books that we feel that really will help you to have a feel of what's going on. We carry, of course, Paul Williams' excellent book on the Al-Qaeda connection that gives you background to so much of what's going on. Of course, what we always like to point out is, how was it that we got into this terrible situation in the Middle East where we are today? Well, in 1953, they had a democratically elected government in Iran, and it was headed by a man named Mossadegh, and the CIA topple that. In fact, the man who was responsible was a man named Colonel Schwarzkopf. And this is covered in Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, History of the World in Our Time. Colonel Schwarzkopf, who had retired from the police force as a commandant of police in one of our major cities, hired by the CIA, they toppled the duly elected government, and they brought the Shah of Iran to power. And from 1953 till 1979, we backed the Shah of Iran. And then the CIA held meetings with the Ayatollah Khomeini and coordinated the toppling of the Shah of Iran. And we have books that were written 10 or 15 years ago and go into the background of that. And if any of you want the references, you can get some of our recent newsletters, and we go into the background, I believe, in our December and January newsletters, and you can get the sources, and we can even get you the pages of the books if you want to see them. The CIA was instrumental in bringing the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. Now, who was directing the CIA at that time? Well, a man named Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was the National Security Advisor. He was the man who created the Trilateral Commission in 1973 for David Rockefeller. And the Trilateral Commission's, why their logo is three intertwining sixes. Six. Six, six. So there is a spiritual component to everything going on, and I can remember back in 1979 saying to myself, why in heaven's name would we topple an administration that was friendly to the United States? Maybe the Shah wasn't the greatest guy in the world. He was an enlightened despot, but he was still a despot. They did not have an elections over there, but the standard of living for most of the people was rising, and the Shah was giving a lot of his wealth and land for the poor peasants. So we topple the enlightened despot, and we bring the radical Islamic clerics to power. In 1979, didn't make a bit of sense. Today, as you look and see what's unfolding, as we're moving towards World War III, towards what I believe is the climax in history, it makes an awful lot of sense. And I think we have to understand there are powerful spiritual forces at work here and in Iran, moving us towards another world war. Well, this is Arthur Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and we have a few minutes more that we can be with you. We want to mention, of course, that we are changing all of our short waves on the 26th, and certainly you can go to our website. New shortwave frequencies will be listed there, and we do hope that many of you will certainly want to get that. And it's going to be a little confusing because we're going to change the frequencies on the 26th, then we're going to change them again on the 2nd of April when we go to daylight saving time. But anyway, of course, you'll be able to get the new changing frequencies. But of course, will be able to get our afternoon and evening programs, I think, at 5.860. That's 5.860. And then our other frequencies you'll be able to get. We'll have this all laid out for you at our internet site. That's radioliberty.com. But I think it's important that you out there listening on this begin to understand that nothing is it appears to be. And if you're looking for logical explanation of what's going on, you're not going to find them. If you understand the spiritual forces that are at work here, propelling America, propelling Iran towards this terrible, terrible coming confrontation, why, I think that things make a lot more sense. Now, Bob Chapman, who we have found to be quite reliable through the years, and he's not always right, but then none of us are always right. But one of the things he had in his last international forecaster, and we know that Bob was with military intelligence and still has a lot of friends in the military, he claims that the Israelis have a number of submarines, which we know they do, diesel submarines, but they still are frighteningly efficient, and the Israeli submarines apparently have stopped at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean recently, and their cruise missiles were fitted with nuclear warheads. Their cruise missiles were fitted with nuclear warheads. Now, why would the Israelis want nuclear-tipped warheads? Well, if they're going to strike, and they're going to do the first strike in Iran, they don't want to do it with planes because they could be shot down. But there's no good defense against cruise missiles with nuclear warheads. Is this true? Well, we're going to be talking to Bob, I think, that tomorrow evening on my evening program. I will ask him that question, how reliable the information is. We put it out there simply as a rumor, but a rumor, I think, with perhaps some justification with some good sources behind it. Anyway, we're living in very, very difficult times. It's very important that if you're out there, that you have a good, close relationship with the Lord. That may be all that's going to get you through the difficult time. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out 5 hours every weekday on about 60 outlets. Now, we're not on 60 outlets every day. We're 60 outlets every week. Some of our programs are just half-hour week programs, but there are about 30 to 35 programs we're on every day. And we do have a voice, shortwave internet, and a voice that's heard throughout the world, but we depend on those of you who listen, who believe, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political battlefield. And we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining, pardon me, to getting a case of my books. We're well over halfway to what we'd need to actually be able to reprint my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't read the book, you should. It gives you an excellent overview of the spiritual forces and the secret societies that are out there that are working to bring about the world government. If you haven't seen my talk, it's available on both DVD and on video, and we think that this will help you to be oriented as to what you're talking about. And if you see the talk and then you read the book, and you have all the sources of documentation for everything that I say, and you can check it out and find if I'm telling the truth. And that if I am telling the truth, we hope you want to become part of our team. But if you'd like to get a case of my books, there's 64 books there. Ordinarily, the books go for $12.95 each. We're selling the case of 64 for $149.95 plus shipping. They will not be printed until we have the full contingent, and we're well over halfway towards having that. And so if you'd like to get the books, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Just had a minister the other day who bought a couple of cases. He wants to give them to all the people in his church. Because he thinks it's important that his congregation know what's going on. So if you'd like to get a case of books, and you can sell them, you can give them away, you can lend them out, but it's an excellent weapon in this spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Again, the number to call, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get Ken Timmerman's excellent book, that's a countdown to crisis. If you'd like to get a copy of any of our programs with him or with John Quirk, who has covered many of the same items he has. John Quirk actually teaches in a diplomatic school in Paris, but he, of course, has reaffirmed much of what Ken Timmerman has said as far as the relationship between Iran and Venezuela. And if we were to go to war with Iran, why, Venezuela would cut off our oil supply. And if you think oil is expensive today, you haven't seen anything at all. We are on the edge of some dramatic changes in the structure of our society. And so our plea to you is become informed, and then, of course, help us educate others and help people to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. That's what it's all about. And if you're looking for logic, well, you're not going to find it. If you're looking for explanation, if you put things into their spiritual perspective, if you understand that the Hojatiya society believes that they can bring the Mahdi back to rule the world, and all the world will be brought under Sharia law, and just as the Hindu waits for the return of the Maitreya, as the Jew waits for the return of their Messiah, and we wait for the Messiah to come again. Why, you know, all of these things are fitting together. It's not imaginary, it's very real, and there really are people who would like to plunge the world into a nuclear holocaust. So with that understanding, our plea to you is become informed and help us educate others. Your job is to get other people to listen to our programs, and of course to encourage them to listen, to challenge. They'll start out thinking we're crazy, and before long, many afraid we're not. And then, of course, remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. Pray for Radio Liberty, please.